Hello, this is Chris Long with the seventh episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Another body has been found. This makes four in 2 days, and they all seem to have known each other. Chapter 47. Pulla called Landry and told her what had happened. "I won't make it there in an hour," he told her. "Sorry." "Does Chief Pollock need me to come in?" "No, I think they've got it covered. Just processing the scene. Your buddy Hooper is working the graveyard shift. I think it's punishment from Bullock for being such a jerk." "I'm starting to like your boss more and more. I'll see you when I see you. Okay if it's late? I'll postpone my walk, but only if you fill me in on the details as soon as you get here. Deal." He clicked off and went back into the house. Bullock was upstairs with his tech guy. Cookie was still dead, still at the bottom of the tub. Bullock was looking around, no fingerprints in the water. But most of these surfaces are great for prints. If they left a trace behind, great. If there's no trace behind, that tells us a lot, too. Means it's been scrubbed, which means he was killed. Dry but damp. He pointed to the floor. Could be from water sloshing around, which would be the case if someone were holding him under. Bullock looked at his tech guy. "Get to it." They both stared down at Cookie's diminutive frame at the bottom of the water. "Hell of a way to go," Bullock noted. "Anytime someone other than the man upstairs decides when you die, it's a hell of a way to go." "So you do think that's what it is, murder?" "I'll wait for the post, but yeah, I wouldn't be stunned if somebody killed him." "Looking a lot like your aunt's situation." "Yeah, it is. I've got a car going to check on this Ryan woman." "That's good. You think she might have done it?" "Cookie was old and small. She's young and bigger and stronger. So yeah, she could have done it." "And her motive?" "No way to tell just yet." Pulla debated and then decided to share it. "My aunt also knew the Storrows." "You really think that's significant?" "Anytime you can tie murder victims together in some way, it's significant. Or at least it could be." "I guess. I'm going to go check into a room at the Gulf Coast. About those men in your room last night. What about them?" "We couldn't hold them. So Landry told me." "For what it's worth, I believe you. 8 against 1 sort of explains itself." "Yeah, it should." "Watch your back. I always have." On the way to his SUV, Pulla scooped up Sadie along with some of her food and a leash. The tiny dog looked up at him mournfully as she sat in Pulla's big hand. "Yeah, I know, Sadie, but it'll be okay." Chapter 48. The first thing was to make them fearful. Well, to make him fearful. Fearful people often took steps to stop that fear. That is, they often made mistakes when they reacted fearfully. Mistakes were good when the other side was committing them. Mako looked up at the grand estate in the darkness. It looked different in the moonlight, but he knew exactly where everything was. Tonight would not be the main assault. Tonight was just the opener. He did not approach the main gate. The use of that gathered intelligence would come later. There were 6 security agents roaming the grounds. They did not use guard dogs. Good for him, because his scent would have already reached them. Dogs were much better guards than humans in that regard. But humans were more dangerous. Dogs only had teeth and claws. Humans carried guns and killed with malice, the only species that did. He had approached from the ocean side, slithering up a dune and then across a stretch of high grass to the fence. The fence did not have electronic monitors or surveillance cameras like the front gate did. It was also not electrified, but there were motion sensors tethered to bright lights. Trip one and you revealed your position. However, Mako had scooped out where all of them were when he was here working. The lights would not trip him up, but he still had to be careful. The defensive philosophy here was a simple but effective one. Put up reasonable outer perimeter measures, like fences and gates. If one got through them, the real defenses, clustered in inner hardened circle around the target, would kick in and stop you. At least that was the theory. He clambered over the fence and dropped silently to the ground. He looked to the east and then to the west. The guards staggered their rounds. He had seen it from prior observation. He had also gained this intelligence from some well-placed questions to other members of the hired help he had encountered while working here. They obviously had no love for their employer. Perhaps they thought Mako was simply a burglar looking to steal from the rich. What did they care about that? Someone who had everything losing a little piece of it. More power to him, they probably thought. But he thought there was another reason for their helpfulness, and it was the most disquieting one of all. It made the anger boil in his chest. It made him want to lash out and crush someone. But those feelings would keep. He would not crush anyone tonight. Not unless he had to. He zigzagged across the lawn, avoiding the motion sensors in the trees. He waited by a clump of bushes as one of the perimeter guards made his rounds. When the man was just past him, Mako struck. The guard crumbled to the ground unconscious, blood running from the head wound. It was not fatal, Mako knew that. He had calibrated his blow to wound, not kill, and he was a man who knew exactly how to do this. He also had the man's weapons, a Smith & Wesson 44 semi-automatic and an MP5, overkill perhaps for a security patrol around a residence, however rich the occupants might be. And you had to multiply that by six, for the other guards were similarly equipped. Florida had very liberal gun ownership laws. As Mako looked down at the fallen man, he had to smile. The fellow apparently was pulling double duty because it was the same man who had yelled at Mako during the day for speaking to Chrissy Murdoch. Well, he would have a nice long sleep tonight. Mako moved on, drawing closer to the house. There was a vintage Bentley convertible parked in the courtyard. A noise from another building drew his attention. The guest house again. He looked at his watch. Could it be? He crept closer. A small light illuminated the front of the building. Mako could see another guard posted by the front door of the guest house. His 44 was holstered and the MP5 hung loosely by its strap across his chest. He looked bored. He was smoking a cigarette. By this, Mako knew he was not a true professional. People who knew what they were doing never smoked on duty. Smelling your opponent before he could attack was sometimes the difference between life and death. As was the split second it would take you to drop the cigarette and close your hand around your weapon. By then you were dead, killed by someone more professional than you. 3 seconds later, the man lay prostrate on the brick walk in front of the guest house. Mako stripped out the ammo clips from both weapons and pocketed them. Then he slid them in behind a bush and crept to the door. The sounds coming from inside were the same ones he'd heard that morning. He opened the door and slipped in. This was not part of the plan tonight, but he took shortcuts when they presented themselves. The house was dark, and he felt his way along. The bedroom was at the end of the hall on the right. He reached it about 5 seconds later. The door was partially open. With the guard outside, they no doubt did not expect to be interrupted. He peered in, with the moonlight pouring in through the window. The room was illuminated well enough for him to see what was happening. Peter J. Lampert was on bottom this time. But it was not Chrissy Murdoch with him. It was Beatrice, the young maid whom Mako had spoken with that morning. She no longer wore her crisp uniform. She no longer wore anything. If Mako had been curious as to whether her body was as beautiful as the rest of her, he had his answer. She was exquisitely lovely. She straddled her employer. His hands were around her waist, and he was smashing her down on him with what Mako see was far too much force. Peter J. Lampert seemed to get a kick out of being overly physical with women. Beatrice was not moaning as Chrissy Murdoch had been, at least not moaning in pleasure. She was moaning in pain. Her small breasts bounced up and down, and Mako could see her butt cheeks wrinkling with each hard collision against Lampert's thighs. Mako tensed, every instinct he had telling him to attack. But instead he pulled back, moved swiftly down the hall, and reached the living room. He looked around and decided this was as good a place as any. He did what he had come to do and then left. Outside, he gave the guy behind the bush a kick in the head, pretending he was Peter J. Lampert. It felt good. He did one more thing before he left. The package was placed 20 meters away from the house, and next to the Bentley convertible that had a license plate reading "The Man." As he crawled over the fence, he counted the seconds off in his head. He reached the beach and kept counting. 50 seconds later, when he was back on firm ground, the explosion occurred, lifting the pristine old Bentley 5 feet up in the air. When it came back down, it hardly looked vintage any more. The blast lit up the night over paradise. Mako didn't look up to watch it as he started his scooter, but he did smile. "Good night, Peter J. Lampett, the man." Chapter 49. Pula drove to the Gulf Coast and checked in. The front desk person was young and sleepy, or maybe just bored. He put his gear away in his room and debated what to do next. He called Landry and told her he was on his way. He hopped into the Tahoe and 20 minutes later pulled into the garage in Destin. It was a humid night with little breeze. Landry met him at the garage elevator. She had changed into shorts and a tank top with sandals. She held up 2 bottles of beer and then eyed Sadie. "You have a dog?" "By default," he explained about Sadie being Cookie's pet. "I can't take her if that's what you're thinking. My building is no pets." "No problem. I just didn't want to leave her alone tonight. Let's do the beach walk. It's cooler down by the water, and you can fill me in on the latest." She glanced at Sadie. "And you can walk your new dog." They trudged across the sand, the breakers rolling over with a growing intensity. "Surf always this rough at night?" "Don't you watch the news?" "Not lately, no. Tropical storm Danielle formed in the Atlantic and entered the Gulf. Don't think it'll strengthen much, but it's rolling up the waters. It'll make landfall around here at some point. They're not exactly sure when." The beach was mostly empty except for several young men stumbling along, beer cans in hand. Paula spent a few minutes filling Landry in on the details of Cookie's death as Sadie walked dutifully next to him, occasionally looking up. The animal must have been confused as hell, thought Paula, because it had a far longer way to look up than it had with Cookie. "What the hell do you think is going on, Puller?" asked Landry after he'd finished. He shrugged. "If people knew something, they're being silenced quite efficiently." "If they knew what?" "If I knew I'd know it all." He glanced at her as they walked along, sipping their beers. Sadie tugged and jerked on the leash, but she was so small that Puller barely noticed. It was like walking a cricket. The cold beer made Puller feel warm. Warmer than the air around him. The waves crashing with tidal regularity made him more relaxed than he normally would have been, particularly after what had happened to Cookie. "You want to go back to my apartment?" asked Landry. "Why?" She looked down. I really like to, but I can't." "Okay, I understand. I know I'm not a girly girl, and I carry a gun at work, but I am a woman. I do like guys, and I'm sure guys like you. I've been hit on by every man under 60 who lives around here, or at least it seems like it. And then the young punks come in from out of town and think they're so hot. But they're just idiots. Lots of guys are idiots. I've been accused of being an idiot. But not with women." "No, not with women." "So that makes you different and attractive." He was very hot now, far hotter than the air. Sweat was on his forehead. He could feel the heat pouring from Landry, too. They could have been inside an oven. "We're working a case together. But you're not on the police force. I wouldn't sleep with you if you were. I don't think you're Hooper's type. He doesn't quite get that. Never stops trying, I'm sure. But we're not talking about Hooper, are we?" she said. "We have no idea where this will lead us, Cheryl. Mixing business and pleasure is never a good idea. You're a very attractive woman, and under other circumstances, my answer might be different. But the conditions on the ground are what they are. I hope you can understand that." "I can. Look, I'm sorry I brought it up. It wasn't professional of me." "We can't be professional all of the time." She smiled resignedly, and they resumed walking. Puller was about to say something when the phone rang. Landry's, not Puller's, and nothing was really the same after that. Chapter 50. Puller followed Landry. Her Toyota flew down the road, and Puller had to keep the Tahoe's pedal nearly rammed to the floor to keep up. Landry was definitely not following the speed limit tonight. Sadie lay next to Puller in the front seat. He kept Landry's brake lights, to the extent that she braked at all, in sight. Landry had taken the call on the beach, the phone mashed to the side of her head. She listened, said almost nothing, and then clicked off and turned to Puller. "That was Chief Bullock. There's been an explosion at the Lambert Estate." Puller had checked his watch, 1:16. As good a time as any to have an explosion, he had thought. "Lambert Estate? What the hell is that?" "It's owned by Peter Lambert, the richest man in paradise. Hell, probably the entire Emerald Coast. Maybe all of Florida. I don't know for sure, but he's loaded." Puller had waited in her apartment while Landry hurriedly changed into her uniform. Then he had picked up Sadie, run to his truck, climbed in, and they were off. He felt that Landry was experiencing extreme guilt. She had not gone back into work after Cookie's murder. There was no reason for her to. There was plenty of manpower to work the scene. But then she had been with Puller when the explosion had occurred. Again, no reason to feel guilty, but he knew Landry was a sort of cop who would. They arrived in Paradise in record time, and he continued to follow Landry through town until they reached the eastern edge. She turned off on a private road, and Puller followed. The Toyota skidded to a stop in front of a pair of impressive steel gates that looked strong enough to withstand an Abrams tank assault. Landry jumped out of her truck. She looked back at Puller as he hurried up to her. He'd left Sadie in the truck with the windows lowered and a full bowl of water. "You want me to go in with you?" She looked uncertain. She had asked him to follow her here, but now her dilemma was obvious, he knew. It was about 2 a.m. Why would the pair of them be together? "I can tell Bullock I heard the explosion, saw you racing through town, and just decided to follow." "Thanks, Puller. I appreciate that." Boyd was at the front gate. Puller figured Hooper was probably back at Cookie's house securing that scene. It was good that Bullock had called Landry in. He would need the manpower. Puller doubted the Paradise Police Department was very big. Boyd looked at Landry the way a man does a woman after he'd been rejected by her. Puller assumed that this was indeed the reason for the look. Landry had said that Hooper and all the other cops had been trying to get her into bed, and it was clear in Boyd's look that the rejection had not gone down well. When he saw Puller right behind her, his features became darker. "What the hell is he doing here with you?" he barked. Before Puller could launch into his cover story, Landry snapped. "He's here to help us work the scene, Boyd. Take it up with the chief if you've got a problem." Before he could say anything, she bowled right past him with Puller riding her wake. They first saw the remains of the Bentley. The chrome radiator, now blackened and bent, was the only part left relatively intact to show the model of the car. Bullock was standing next to it. His crime scene tech was walking the perimeter of the blast site, apparently making some calculations. When Bullock saw Landry and Puller, he waved them over. Unlike Boyd, he didn't bother to ask why they were here together, so Puller did not need to use his bogus explanation. "Got here as fast as I could, Chief," Landry said quickly. "Looks like a bomb was right under the car. Blew out some windows in the house, too." "This Lambert guy have enemies?" "Well, it appears likely he has at least one." "What do you know about him?" "Came here from South Beach about 5 years ago, built this place." "Well, he was building it before he came here. Took the better part of 3 years to finish the sucker." "How'd he make his money?" "Finance guy or something. Who the hell knows how these guys make money? They robbed Peter to pay Paul." "I take it no one was in the car." "No." "Anything else? Isn't a car bombing enough?" "Two guards were attacked, one near the rear fence, the other over near the guest house." He pointed in the direction of the building, found them both unconscious. They were pretty burly guys. Whoever took them out was a force to be reckoned with. "They finally came to. We questioned both, but they never saw who attacked them." "Anyone currently staying there currently?" "No." "Is it okay if I take a walk around the grounds?" "Looking for what? I usually know it when I see it." He left them and walked around the edge of the property. He could see men in black shirts with sidearms and MP5s lurking here and there. Security, who got their asses kicked tonight. And Lambert would probably kick them again. But why blow up the car? A message. Was it a message enough? He looked at the main house ablaze in light. When his gaze ventured to the darkened guest house, why one would require a guest house when you lived in a mansion bigger than the White House was beyond him. But he supposed at that income bracket there were no items of necessity, only items of desire. But then certain possibilities occurred to him. Why have security at the guest house if no one was currently there? He ventured to one of the windows of the structure and hit the flower bed with his penlight. Nothing. He moved around the house, checking the dirt. Nothing. Until the third try. Footprints. Big ones. He held his own foot over one of the prints and came up short by a lot. He estimated a size 16, a big man. He took a picture of it with his cell phone. Maybe just a yard worker cleaning the flower beds. He looked through the window, clean shot into what appeared to be a bedroom. Okay, maybe it wasn't as simple as a yard worker, and the print was on the house side of the flower bed. Why get so close to the building? The footprint didn't look particularly recent. It was hard to say, but they must have irrigation here. So he doubted it had been here longer than a day. Otherwise, the water would have dissolved the print. Now he needed to see what it was the person was looking at. Chapter 51. The door was unlocked. The interior was dark. Puller used his penlight to see where he was going. Technically, he probably wasn't supposed to be in here, and he didn't want to call attention to the fact that he was. In his mind, he figured out what room that window looked into. A few minutes later, he stepped into the room. Now he had confirmation that it was indeed a bedroom. If this had been a hotel room, it would have been one Puller could have afforded. He eyed the bed. It was made, but Puller was used to the military precision of square corners and a bed tight enough to bounce a quarter off. This bed was not to that level, and it had a discernible imperfection. There was a slight bump near the footboard. In the light, it would have been hard to make out. In the dark, it was pretty much invisible, but not to Puller. He carefully lifted up the bed covers and shined his penlight under it. It was a pair of women's panties. He snapped a picture with his cell phone. Someone had made the bed in haste and forgotten this item. He put the bed covers back down and glanced at the window, perfect sight line to here. He noted the two glass ring marks on the nightstand and sniffed them. Some of the liquid had spilled. Not a big drinker, Puller still knew what it was by the smell. Scotch. It had been a favorite of his old man's. He next scrutinized the bedposts and saw the scratches on one of them. Fingernails, maybe? He went into the adjacent bedroom, checked out the trash can, vanity, toiletry, shower, and toilet. All of these things together were telling Puller a lot about what had happened in here. When he went back out, he saw it in the front room. He shined his penlight over it. Someone had written on the wall in magic marker. Your time is almost up, Pete. Puller glanced back at the bedroom door, and then his gaze returned to the writing. He took a picture of it with his cell phone camera. Now there was a message that was even more direct than blowing up your super expensive car. He had no doubt that the message had been seen, and he was certain it would have been erased in time. Bullock had made no mention of this, so obviously Lambert, if he had been in here, it didn't want the police to know about it. And there was no reason for the police to come into the guest house, and they hadn't, just Puller had. He slipped out of the space and made his way back to the wreckage of the Bentley where Landry was talking to Bullock. He walked over to the tech who was poking around the car's remains. Find the source of the explosion yet? Pieces of it. He held up a baggie with a twisted fragment of scorched metal inside. I think this is the detonator, at least part of it. Puller took the bag and looked at it. He had seen debris like this before. In fact, he had seen enough IEDs in the Middle East to last him a lifetime. He had also analyzed the remains of many exploded IEDs. Most bombs had common components. Explosive element, detonator, timer, and power source, but different bombers had different techniques for creating their stuff. The bomb signature, it was called. Puller had gotten to where he could tell at a glance which local bomber had constructed a certain IED. This detonator debris, however, was not from the Middle East. It was not any that he recognized, and he was pretty confident he would have. So other things being equal, the bomber had not come from that part of the world. It would have been a stretch anyway. A jihadist in Paradise, Florida, The irony was a little much. Bullock and Landry joined him. Bullock pointed at the evidence baggie and said, "Anything strike you about that bomb fragment?" "Well, I'm no ATF expert, but I've seen lots of Middle East bombs, and this isn't one of them. If I had to guess, I'd say it was more Russian than anything else." "Russian? We got Russians blowing up cars in the panhandle?" "Not necessarily. The bomb might be Russian-made, but whoever set it off doesn't have to be. The Russians sell to whoever is willing to pay." He handed the baggie back to the tech and looked up at the main house. It was the biggest home he had ever seen. The guest house had been about 4,000 square feet. He couldn't tell how many square feet this was. Perhaps they didn't use square feet when measuring it. Perhaps they used acres, and there were about 44,000 square feet in an acre. Peter Lambert must do quite well for himself, but his time was coming, at least according to the writing left in the guest house. He had already decided not to tell Bullock and Landry about it. He shouldn't have gone in the guest house, and by telling them he would have to admit of what he'd done. Puller pointed at the house. "You questioned them yet?" "Was just going to," he said to Bullock. "You want to sit in?" Puller stared at him for a moment, suddenly disquieted by how nice the chief was being to him. Even Landry raised her eyebrows at this offer. "I'll just be part of the peanut gallery. Suit yourself, but if something occurs to you, speak up. With all the crap that's happening, I'm thinking I need all the help I can get. Otherwise, I'm going to be the former police chief of Paradise." They walked inside to question Peter J. Lambert and company. Chapter 52. The first thing Puller noticed was that Peter Lambert was fully dressed, white slacks, dark shirt, and sandals, but his hair was slightly damp, so the guy had showered. Showered at this hour of the night, maybe after having sex. He wondered who else had showered. Lambert was sipping a drink from a bar that spanned one entire wall of a room that seemed as big as an airplane hangar, but was decorated to look like Buckingham Palace. He came forward and held out his hand to Bullock. "Nice of you to come personally, Chief." Bullock nodded and shook his hand. "Sure thing, Mr. Lambert." Lambert's gaze flitted across Landry and then came to rest on Puller. He gazed up at him as he jiggled the ice in his cut crystal glass. "And who do we have here?" "John Puller," said Puller. "Army CID," Puller said quickly. "He's just here observing, Mr. Lambert." Lambert kept his gaze on Puller for another few seconds and then smiled and finished off his drink. "You're very calm for someone who just had his car blown up," said Puller, who had decided to step out of the peanut gallery. Lambert held up the empty glass. "That's what 33-year-old McCallahan is for. Replenishes the spine in no time." "Scotch," thought Puller, "like in the guest house. Then it just came down to who did the underwater underwear belong to." Two more people came into the room, a man and a woman. They looked like models for Ralph Lauren, all American with nary a flaw. The man was in shorts and a t-shirt. The woman had on a light blue thigh-high silk robe. They apparently had been in bed when it had happened. Guy threw on whatever was handy. Lady stepped into her robe. The woman's hair wasn't damp. "James Winthrop and Christine Murdoch," Lambert said by way of introduction. "James works with me, and Chrissy his significant other." He gave Murdoch a little smile and then turned his attention back to Puller. Puller checked out both of them closely. Winthrop looked scared, Murdoch simply intrigued. That was miles apart on the emotional barometer, and Puller wondered why the man and his significant other would be so dissimilar in their reactions to tonight's events. After all, a bomb was a bomb. "Of course we heard the explosion," said Murdoch. "What time was that?" "I looked at my watch when I jumped out of bed. It was nearly 1:15. Landry wrote this down in her notebook. Bullock asked, "Did either of you see or hear anything unusual before or after the explosion?" They both shook their heads. "Where were you when it happened?" he asked Lambert. "I was in my room. My wife is out of town. I was reading a book, and then all hell broke loose. Before, I didn't see or hear anything unusual." Puller didn't know if Landry and Bullock had noticed the man's wet hair or wondered why Lambert was, unlike his guests, fully dressed. Did your security personnel see anyone? Not a thing, apparently. I thought they were the best in the business. Right now I feel like firing all of them and starting over. He glanced at Puller. Army CID? Puller nodded. And before that, Ranger. Then you could be a first-rate security person. Whatever Uncle Sam's paying you, I'll double it. Puller had no idea if the guy was being serious or not, but he said, sorry, it doesn't work that way. Anything works if you want it badly enough. Yeah, you have any idea who could have done this? I've had a business career filled with ups and downs. I've made enemies. Screwing someone in business usually leads to a lawsuit, not a bombing. Who says I screwed anyone? Lambert said, dropping his friendly demeanor. Murdoch broke in. I think he was just speaking in generalities, Peter. Lambert kept his gaze on Puller. Is that what it was, generalities? Let's assume it was. Anyone on that list who would blow up your car? There might be. We'll need those names. Okay. To Puller, Lambert looked uninterested by the whole thing. Most people who had a bomb go off in their front yard would have been a little more stressed out. Lambert was either really stupid or there was a lot more to all of this, and Lambert didn't seem stupid. Anything else? I need to get some sleep. We'll continue our investigation outside, and we'll follow up tomorrow. Sounds good, Lambert replied. Bullock and Landry turned to leave through the front door. Murdoch and Winthrop turned to go back to their rooms. Puller stood right where he was. The light blue robe was quite tight. From behind, Puller could see the outline of Murdoch's underwear, and the panties in the guest house seemed a little small to be hers. Not conclusive, of course, but interesting nonetheless. He glanced over and saw Lambert staring at him, like he had just read Puller's mind. You have any other guests staying with you, Mr. Lambert? A thin smile spread across Lambert's face. Nope, just the hired help. Bullock and Landry had turned back when this exchange started. They both stared with puzzled looks at Puller. Just the hired help. Thanks, Mr. Lambert. That's all I needed to know. Lambert smiled and held up his glass. I'm sure it is, Mr. CID. I'm sure it is. Puller walked out. Chapter 53. Another 80 had been delivered tonight, just like clockwork. 4 boats worth. They looked just like the last shipment, destroyed. Mako watched from a different spot tonight. He did not like patterns. Patterns could get you killed. He had no reason to believe that anyone suspected he was here, but he had no reason to think that they didn't either. He imagined these men lived their lives full of suspicion, just as he did. After the bomb went off at Lambert's house, they would have to proceed with caution. Calling off tonight's shipment might have been tempting for them, but apparently the allure of a mountain of dollars was too much, and the boat was probably already on its way when the Bentley had been blown up. So the show went on. These folks wore the color-coded clothing of the previous group. As he observed them, Mako concluded that tonight was heavy on drug mules and prostitutes, by far the most profitable. The simple laborers, the one who silently mowed grass in nice southern suburbs, or mutely hefted cartons in warehouses in the Midwest, brought the least amount of money. But the profit margins were still excellent, just not off the scale like those associated with the drugs and hookers' revenue streams. The 4th RIP turned and headed back out to the mothership. Mako turned his attention to the truck in which the 80 people had been placed. The rear door came down and was bolted shut. The back of the truck would be soundproofed, of course. No screams would be heard, though Mako imagined the prisoners were probably too terrified to utter a sound. He hustled to his scooter and climbed aboard. When the truck started off with its 2 SUV motorcade, Mako fell in behind, keeping about 800 yards back. He did not worry about losing the vehicles. He had placed a tracking device on the underbelly of the truck while the first shipment of passengers was arriving on the beach. The guards had made the mistake of moving away from the vehicles to draw nearer to the beach, never thinking that leaving their rear flank exposed would be a problem. Yet it was a problem, a big one. But one man's problem was another man's opportunity. They traveled east for 4 miles, their route gradually leading from the Gulf as they did so. The destination was not surprising, a warehouse in the middle of a decrepit industrial park. This was far away from the tourist traps and nowhere near the pristine white beaches or the emerald green waters. This had the look and stench of the real world, a world where people toiled away for crap wages, doing lousy work and wondering when their ship was going to come in. Mako understood that very well. He had wondered that very same thing, only far away from here, a universe away from here, in fact. Where is my damn ship? Well, maybe it was a RIB with human cattle on it. After the truck drove through the open overhead door of the warehouse, the door rattled down behind it. One SUV had driven in with the truck. The other had stayed outside. Mako had a good idea what was happening inside the warehouse. It was like U.S. Customs processing in a way, and in a way the farthest thing from it. The folks in the truck were being let off, dressed in different clothes and given certain documentation. A bit to eat, a few ounces of water to drink. They were being told things, things that would further demoralize their spirits. You will do exactly as we say. And if you don't, not only will you die, but your entire family back in the little village or town or city where we took you from will die too. No exceptions, ever. The instructions would be given. They would be able to sleep for a bit. They would be segregated according to their ultimate function. The future prostitutes would be given the best accommodations and rations. Their looks and overall health mattered, at least for now. Later they wouldn't. And then they would be discarded, most drugged beyond rehab, and they'd shuffle away and die alone. The drug mules would be given things, too, things that would allow their innards to receive more bags of drugs than they would have thought possible. 10% of them would suffer ruptures of these bags while they were still inside them. All 10% would die from it. Heroin or coke pouring into one's bloodstream in such profound doses is not something the body was built to endure, because nowhere in the evolutionary chain did humans have to adapt to such treatment. That was good for humanity, bad for the 10%. The 10% was known in the industry as a reasonable and acceptable cost of business. Indeed, like credit card companies that jack up interest rates to cover losses from hackers and deadbeats, the slavers up their chattel rates to cover these losses. Businesses always passed the costs along, whether they were selling hammers or humans. Again, there was nothing Mako could do to help the 80 people in the warehouse tonight. That was not why he was here. He sat on his scooter just outside the gate of the fence that surrounded this industrial park and waited. He took a photo out of his pocket. While it was dark and he had killed his scooter light before approaching the warehouse area, Mako could see in his mind's eye the image of the young woman in the picture he held. She looked a lot like Mako. There was a reason for that. Family was family. Her name was Rada. In his language, her name meant joyfulness, and she had once possessed it in abundance, but no longer. That he knew without knowing it for certain. Sometimes Mako wished that Rada were dead. Being alive and doing what she was doing must be worse than being dead. He had no idea where in the world she was. He had come here to get an idea, but that was not all. There were other pictures in his jacket pocket, all women, all young. These women were not related to him, but that did not matter. There was another connection, a strong one, that was enough for him. He had no idea where in the world any of them were, and it was a big world. He needed help. Tonight would begin his attempts to find such help. An hour went by, and the overhead door opened. The SUV zipped out, and the door closed once more. The second SUV stayed where it was while the first SUV approached the gates. They automatically opened, and the SUV sped through them. Mako knew there were four men in the SUV. As he started up his scooter to follow them, it didn't matter to him which one of the four would provide the assistance. He would work through them all until he got it. To him, they were no longer human, just like they treated the people in the truck. They were there for him to use in any way he chose, to achieve his goals. In a way, he was a businessman, too. Only his incentive, his profit, was not measured in money. It was measured in justice. It was calculated in revenge. And in Mako's case, those two things were exactly the same. Chapter 54. The hotel was far nicer than the Sierra, and it was right on the water. The SUV was packed in the hotel's garage. The four men had ridden the elevator to the lobby and then gone on to their rooms. They each had their own, a perk of this job. Money, obviously, was no limitation. The man who had ridden shotgun in the SUV reached his room on the 15th floor and opened the door with his key card. He slipped off his jacket, revealing his holstered Glock 9. He made a beeline for the minibar and mixed a gin and tonic, then went to the window and gazed out over the gulf. He took a long breath and slipped a cigarette from his pocket and lit up. It was a non-smoking room, but he apparently didn't care. 30 minutes later, there was a knock at the door. Not his hotel room door, but the one connecting the room next to his. One of the other men was staying in that room. He walked over to it. Donnie?
Yep.
What's up? Call from the boss. We got a roll. Oh, got something for you, said Donnie. He opened the door. The blow hit him so hard it lifted him off his feet, and he flew backward and landed on the soft bed, his nose broken and his consciousness gone. Donnie stood there with a gun barrel held against his right temple. Mako was behind him. Please, man, don't kill me. Mako shoved him into the room and closed the door behind him. A ferocious blow to Donnie's head dropped him to the floor. When he awoke later, he was tied to the bed along with his colleague, who was now awake as well. The two men looked at each other. Mako stood over them looking down. He duct-taped their mouths, pulled their pants and underwear down, and held the knife pointed at their privates. When he cut him down there, Donnie screamed, but it was nearly soundless one with the duct tape across his mouth. The next instant, Mako slammed the knife straight into his chest, so hard that the point came out the man's back and stuck into the mattress. Donnie's mouth sagged open as he died. The other man looked in panic at his dead colleague. Mako took off the other man's duct tape. The man braced for the strike of the knife, but Mako just looked at him. The man glanced at dead Donnie. Why did you kill him? He'd tell you anything you wanted to know. I killed him because I could. What do you want to know? The other man said, his voice panicky. What is your name? He asked quietly. Joe. Where are you from, Joe? New Jersey. What is this New Jersey? It's a state, one of the United States. Do you have a family? Joe hesitated, but Mako pointed the blade at his chest, and Joe said, wife and two little girls in New Jersey? Joe nodded, his eyes filling with tears. And you want to see them again? Yes, more than anything. And the people from the boats, Joe's chest heaved more, and he sobbed. It's just a job. They have family, too. I just do it for the money. I swear to Jesus, it's the only reason. I got nothing against those people. They have people they love and who love them. Just a damn job, that's all, moaned Joe. Mako took out the photo of Rita and held it in front of Joe. Do you recognize this person? Her name is Rita. Joe's eyes were so filled with tears he could barely see. I don't know. Do you know her? I'm not sure. Maybe. Her name is Rita. I don't know any of their names. We don't get names. She is a beautiful woman. About a month ago, she came through here. Were you here then? Joe started to nod, sensing perhaps that if he had visible, valuable intelligence, it would keep him alive. Wait a minute. Yeah, I think I do remember her. Right. A month ago. Yeah, Rita. Rita, repeated Mako. 1 month ago. You want to find her, right? Maybe I can help. 1 month ago, Rita, she is beautiful. Absolutely, a real looker. I can help you if you untie me. Mako slammed the blade into Joe's chest and drove it up to the hilt. Joe gave a shudder and joined Donnie in the land of the dead. Mako stared down at him. Rita has been gone for 1 year, he fingered the photo, and this is not a picture of Rita. He looked at dead Donnie, and your friend already told me all I needed to know back in his room. He pulled his knife free, and some pent-up arterial blood squirted from the room. With the heart no longer beating and zero blood pressure, there would not be any more significant blood loss. Mako said, so, You can see that I have no further need of your assistance. I perhaps forgot to mention that. Forgive me, Joe. I'm sure your family in this New Jersey place will mourn you. He stood, wiped the blade off on the sheets, and stared down at the two men. For the money. Just for the money. They did not know the names. They never knew the names. But I know their names. I know them all. Chapter 55. Pulla sat in his room at the Gulf Coast, staring at the wall. Sadie was curled up at the end of his bed. The dog had drunk so much water that she had peed in the Tahoe. Pulla had cleaned that up and then walked her before coming up to his room. It was 4 a.m. and he had not yet been to sleep. There were many items swirling through his mind. At 4:30, he closed his eyes and willed himself to rest for 3 hours. When he woke at 7:30, he felt like he'd slept for a full 8 hours. He showered and dressed, walked Sadie, and then fed her with food he had taken from Cookies. He walked the dog again to let her do her business and then went out to eat breakfast, leaving Sadie back in the thankfully air-conditioned room. He knew he would have to make other arrangements for the dog, but that was not at the top of his priority list right now. He walked 2 blocks to the waterfront and found a small diner with a 50s retro interior and ordered the biggest breakfast it offered. In deference to the heat outside, the temperature was already in the 80s. He had water with ice in lieu of coffee. Fully fueled, he left the diner and walked down the street. Did you get enough to eat? He turned and saw her standing by the mailbox. Julie Carson was not in uniform. She had on jeans, sandals, and a green sleeveless blouse. She didn't look like the one star that she was. She looked like a tourist, a very fit, attractive tourist. Pulla walked over to her. I'm more than a little surprised, General, he said. I'll take that as a compliment, since I know it's very difficult to surprise you, Agent Puller. And you can make it Julie, no uniform today. And you can make it John. When did you get in? Grabbed a free seat on a cargo plane into Elgin. Little perks we generals get. Got in around midnight last night. And you found me how? How many guys that look like you are in paradise? He watched her, awaiting her real answer. Okay, I ran your credit card activity, saw you checked into the Gulf Coast. Then you should have had breakfast with me. I overslept. I knew you'd be up early to get chow. That diner seemed to be your sort of place. I was about to walk in when you walked out. And you're here, why? Had a week of leave I never took. Found out J2 could get along without me for a few days. Your description of paradise sounded so inviting, it was an easy decision. It might not meet your expectations. Let a girl decide that for herself, John. I take it you want to be updated on my investigation, even though you're here on R&R. I crave information, so why don't we go back into the diner and I can eat and you can have a gallon of water to keep hydrated and we can have ourselves a nice conversation. And they did exactly that. Pulla saw that Carson had an appetite. She put away eggs, pancakes, bacon, and grits, and while she drank 3 glasses of water, she also had 2 cups of coffee. While she worked through her meal, Pulla brought her up to speed on all events, including the explosion at the Lambert Mansion the night before. Carson took 1 last sip of water and set her glass down. You've been busy. I've been reactive, actually, not an ideal situation. 8 guys, I'm impressed. I only took out 6. If the big man hadn't been there, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So if I've got this right, you're investigating your aunt's suspicious death and her neighbor's murder. You also have the disappearance of this kid, Diego. There are 2 guys down here following you who are so well connected the Pentagon gets stonewalled, and some rich guy gets his Bentley blown sky high, and I almost forgot the murders on the beach. The 2 guys might have been following me. They could have been picked up my tail from when I visited my aunt, meaning their focus was her, not you, which leads credulence to the theory that she was murdered. That's how I see it, which prompts the question of what the hell she was involved in that would get her that kind of attention. You sure she wasn't some retired spy with a dark past? If she was, she was damn good at keeping her cover. No, I think she found out something down here, and that's what got her killed. I wish she had been more specific in her letter, but she wasn't. You mentioned mileage on her car. Right. 5 miles out and five back. At least that's my speculation. Jane Ryan said that 5 miles east seemed the best bet, but I'm not sure about her now, considering what happened to Cookie. Have the police found her? Don't know. By now they should have, I guess. She might be able to clear some things up if she's involved. Maybe. So what's the next move? You really sure about this, Julie? I mean, you don't have to do this. I've been covering enlisted men's backs most of my career. It's why I'm beloved by the rank and file. Besides, my last few vacations have followed similar patterns and have been pretty boring. And my J2 assignment, while necessary for my career path, is pretty damn uninteresting at times. I need some excitement. Puller looked across the table at her. Well, I think you came to the right place. But keep in mind that at least 4 people have died so far. I can take care of myself. I thought the same thing about me, and I almost bought it. The punks I dealt with are nothing special. I just messed up, but got lucky. I can't count on being lucky again. She looked across at him, her amused features turning more serious. So we treat this just like combat? Just like combat. So the next move? The most obvious. We found out if the police have picked up Jane Ryan. And if they haven't, then we find her before someone else does. You really think she killed this Cookie person? I have no idea, but if she did, she might also have killed my aunt. And all the other stuff that's been happening down here, you think it's all connected? Puller thought about this for several long seconds while the sounds of traffic picked up out on the street as Paradise came to life. I don't believe in coincidences. Meaning what exactly? Meaning exactly that I don't believe in coincidences. Chapter 56. When they came out of the diner, a police car was zipping past. It screeched to a stop, and Cheryl Landry leaned her head out. You're not going to believe this, she began before her gaze came to rest on Carson. Puller noted this and said, General Julie Carson, Officer Cheryl Landry. As Puller's gaze swiveled between the two women, he felt a pang of guilt. He had been out twice with Carson, though the first time was not a real date. However, he sensed the general was interested in something deeper than mere friendship. Landry clearly wanted a relationship with him. Thus, having the two women together was deeply discomforting. Nice to meet you, Officer Landry. I've never met a general before. Well, now you have, and we don't look any different from anyone else. I won't believe... What? Said Puller. Two more murders at the Plaza Hotel, 2 blocks down. 2 guys in a bedroom, stabbed to death, it appears. 2 guys? Landry nodded. I know what you're thinking. I don't know if it's the same 2 who you think have been following you. You want us to come? Asked Puller. Landry glanced at Carson and then at Puller. Puller, sensing her indecision, said, Make the offer to Bullock. He can make the call if he wants. Thanks. Did you pick up Jane Ryan? But Landry had already hit the gas, and the car had sped off. Puller looked at Carson. 2 more dead? Who knew Paradise could be so damn bloody, said Carson. And of course, it can't be a coincidence, she added, raising her eyebrows at him. Don't think so. So we wait until we get the okay from this Bullock guy, and what about Ryan? We can check her out. But while we're here, I want to find out something else. She followed him down the street and away from the beach. The sun seemed to be fighting its way to the top of the sky with astonishing speed. Carson wiped a bead of sweat off her brow and picked up her pace so she was walking next to Puller. What's this place we're heading to? Diego's. They passed the Sierra and Puller arrived at the building with the blue awning. He marched up to the second story and knocked on the door. No one came. He knocked again and then a third time. He heard footsteps and relaxed slightly as Carson looked at him expectantly. The door opened. Puller had thought it would be one of the 2 people, Diego or Isabel. Well, maybe 3 if one counted little Mateo. It was none of them. This woman standing there was in her 60s, short and plump, with brown hair streaked heavily with silver. Her face was thickly lined and a prominent mole had grown in the crevice between her cheek and nose. She was dressed in sweatpants, cheap sneakers, and a dark top. She looked curiously from Puller to Carson. See? So this was the Abdullah, thought Puller, the grandmother. Hable inglés, señora? Yes, poquito. My name is John Pulla. I know Diego and Isabel and Mateo. I helped them out the other day. They might have told you. Yes, they tell me. Then her face collapsed and her shoulders started to shake. Pulla put a hand under her arm to keep the woman from slumping to the floor. What's wrong? Los Ninos. They no here. Where are they? ¿Dónde están los niños? Amended Carson. No si, desperadizo. They vanished? Carson nodded. That's what she said. Have you called the police? No policia. Carson said, it doesn't sound as though she likes the police very much. She could be undocumented, and the kids, too. Right. Pulla looked at the sobbing woman and said to Carson, it could be the guys I beat up, but something feel me it's not. But Diego did help me track down the two guys. So the two guys made them disappear? I guess that's the most likely answer. Diego was following them. Maybe they spotted him, and Isabel and Mateo were with him. Pulla felt sudden guilt for involving Diego in this. Unless the two guys are lying dead at the plaza, still could have been them. Diego and his cousins might have escaped from them. After killing the two guys, Carson said skeptically. Pulla looked at the woman again. The woman shook her head and told Pulla that only God could help her now. She shut the door, and Pulla stood staring off over Carson's shoulder. Should we report it? She asked. We might do more harm than good if the kids are okay. They might end up getting deported. Better than being dead, John. Yeah, I know. We can ask around. Maybe someone has seen them. That's a good idea. Diego has some friends around here. They might know something. It took them 20 minutes to locate Diego's friends. The first had not seen Diego for 2 days. The second one had seen him yesterday. Was he with anyone? Asked Pulla. The boy held out his hand. Pulla put a $5 bill in it. Yes. Who? Asked Carson. The boy held out his hand again. Carson put a $1 bill in it. The boy said nothing. Pulla said, you tell us something useful, there'll be more. Otherwise, the ATM is shut down for the day. The boy looked around and said, he is with the Dueños de la Cal. The Street Kings? Yes, the Street Kings. What is he doing with them? The boy held out his hand and Carson put another $1 in it. I think he is trying to join. If he is stupid. They are a very bad gang. What about Isabel and Mateo? Pulla asked. The boy withdrew his hand and put the cash in his pocket. He shrugged. I do not know about them. Where do we find the Street Kings? Asked Pulla. You do not want to find the Street Kings, senor, said the boy. Actually, yes, I do. Where? Pulla held out a $20. Ahora. The boy gave him an address, and they ran off. Pulla looked at Carson. You don't have to go with me. The hell I don't. This is just getting interesting. You have any weapons? You're asking a one-star if she has any weapons? Other women might like shoes and nail polish. I grew up on Winchesters and Colts on a farm in Oklahoma, so I brought some goodies with me. Okay, so we might want to gun up for this. Hell, John, I don't think there's any might about it. This concludes the 7th episode of The Forgotten by David Baldacci. Your reader has been Chris Long.